Don't make me come over the dime.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the House Judiciary Committee. We are going to move into our agenda today, and I'm going to take a couple of bills at the bottom of the agenda early. Also announce to the committee that I have to step out at about 2 o'clock for a meeting on public safety funding issues in the governor's conference room, but would hopefully either be back before we were done with the agenda or that you would be able to finish the agenda without me. So for the committee's information, we're going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 618, and I'll open that public hearing right now. Also, so you know, we're going to then move to Senate Bill 764, and I've alerted Senator Starr, who is asked to come speak to the bill, and so hopefully he will be en route, and we'll take him when he arrives. So with that, I'll ask Ted Falk and Astrid Newell to come forward. Welcome. Please proceed.
Chairman Williams and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Astrid Newell, and I am the medical consultant for the Office of Family Health in the Oregon Department of Human Services. I'm also the co-chair of the State Advisory Committee on Genetic Privacy and Research. And I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 618A. There's several things Bill just passed out, several items that I wanted to call your attention to. This, I don't know if it's around yet, this large document is the legislative report that the committee put together after their deliberation over the past year. It's fairly lengthy. But this is really covers in depth our discussions. There's a one pager that goes over the Senate Bill A engrossed version, kind of line by line. This PowerPoint presentation was we gave this to the Senate Judiciary Committee, and it gives some background about genetics and some of the things that we've talked about in our committee over the past year. Senate Bill 618A is the result of a year-long study by a 14-member committee. The committee is appointed by the Department of Human Services as well as by the Senate and House. And this bill is really a housekeeping bill. The current genetic privacy law, which was passed in 2001, Senate Bill 114, is now in place, and we after reviewing the current law, decided to make some recommendations for changes. And the bill before you clarifies terminology in the current genetic privacy statutes. It clarifies the current provisions requiring notification and an opportunity to decline participation in anonymous research, and delays the effective date of that provision to the date of the 2003 law. And the reason for that request for a delay is that the committee felt that the researchers didn't have enough time in the past year to understand what the rules were. It establishes criteria for coded genetic research, where genetic materials are identifiable only through a use of a system of encryption. It adds a transitional clause to allow genetic research to be conducted under the provisions of the provisions that were in effect at the time of an IRB or Institutional Review Board approval. It adds an additional member to the committee to represent public education, and it establishes the charge to our committee for the next biennium, and that will include continuing to study definitions such as the definition of genetic information, continuing to study informed consent issues, genetic testing and insurance, gene patenting, and continued work on public outreach and education. genetic science and technology are evolving at a rapid rate, and it's critical that we have a body in Oregon to continue to review and study things as they emerge. And the committee that has been working over the past year has been a group of experts, and it's been a great experience. And I think that the group has really come together in consensus to present the bill that's before you today. The Department of Human Services has continued to be actively involved in the committee. We serve as staff, we facilitate meetings, and we are doing this currently within our existing resources, and Senate Bill 618 has no anticipated fiscal impact. Over the past year, the committee has actually sought outside resources to do outreach, public education outreach. We've actually been awarded several grants from foundations, and so this is a committee that's very active and very and looking into getting resources that do not rely on state funds. And so in summary, the department believes that this Senate Bill 618 improves upon Oregon's current law. It's a housekeeping bill, but we do encourage that you support this bill. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Newell. Are there questions for Dr. Newell? Is Mr. Falk not going to be joining us today?
I think not. I think he expected it to be later in the agenda, but okay. I'm happy to answer any questions.
We sometimes do that, and I apologize.
Oh, that's okay. Thank you.
Are there questions for Dr. Newell about either the bill or the report? Committee, if you're interested, you can turn to under Exhibit B of the report in... You'll get to see who the members are of the advisory committee and who's the member, and then also their alternate representative on the committee. It's I remember, I think the first genetic privacy bill passed in 1995.
That's correct.
And I actually was counsel to the Senate committee when that bill went through. And I think there's been some version of a genetic privacy bill in almost every session since then. And I suspect that you'll continue to have more recommendations as both the science and technology advance and the issues become more defined. Are there questions? All right.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Crummell.
With regards to the genetic privacy, there's not anything in the bill that has anything to do with it always concerns me when you say it's a housekeeping bill. There's not anything that having to do with how the information is used, other than it's kept encrypted and private, and so genetic information about any individual is not released to any kind of a third party. Is that correct?
Chair Williams, Representative Crummell, the current bill that's before you does not change the current law in regards to obtaining, retaining, and disclosing genetic information. So those provisions are still in place.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else? Okay, thank you, Dr. Newell.
Thank you.
Mr. Falk isn't here. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 618?
I'll just say Ted Falk is the other co-chair of the committee.
Great. Thank you. And he had signed up in favor of the bill. We've just advanced the schedule ahead of him. So is there anybody else? All right. Then I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 618. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 618.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I move Senate Bill 618 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves Senate Bill 618 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Just to say that having followed the work of this work group by email anyway during the last interim, I'd say it was one of the most active and productive work groups I've seen in some time. So I want to congratulate Dr. Newell for the work that where is she?
She's there.
Oh, there she is. Yeah, the work that they've done. And I know the last session's bill was probably the harder bill in a lot of the policy area, but they followed up on that with this bill very well. And I think they did a great job.
All right. Anything else? Okay, Ann, if you want to call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Newell? Representative Trumbull.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative Kozlowski.
Aye.
Representative Cheverly.
Aye.
Vice President.
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Aye.
Chair Williams.
Aye. Senate Bill 618 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteer carrier on this one? Well, somebody who's been following the issue on the email. Representative Cheverly.
All right.
I'll teach you. All right. Well, I still don't see Senator Starr. Do we have an update on his progress? They're trying to find him? Okay. Well, why don't we hold off? And we'll go to the top of the agenda and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 59.
Mr. Chairman, do you have the list?
Yep.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 59 deals with when a district attorney or a person who is seeking to forfeit items must file the petition for forfeiture. There are also some dash one amendments. The bill as it's written would increase the time in which that might be filed from 15 to 30 days, and the dash one amendments should be before you as well as a engrossed version of them. And this would deal with forfeiting dangerous weapons in light of what has happened to criminal forfeiture since 2001 with the measure and Chapter 666, which is mentioned in here, is the legislation that was put in to comply with the new constitutional amendments and deals with forfeiting a dangerous weapon and takes it out of some of those provisions of 666.
Okay. Thanks, counsel. We have up Mr. Durbin. And Diana.
Vitalins.
Say it again.
Vitalins.
Is it Dana?
Dinah.
Sorry.
That's Diana, okay. Dana. All right. Did you write this or did Officer Durbin write this?
I did.
All right. It's your fault. I can't pronounce her name right. Blame him.
I do often.
All right. Good. Who wants to start?
Please.
Chair
Williams, members of the committee. As Mr. Prinz indicated, Senate Bill 59 simply increases the time within which a prosecutor has to submit a case to grand jury and obtain an indictment for criminal forfeiture from 15 days to 30 days. The members of the group who worked on the bill in the previous session all agreed that prosecutors should have 30 days in order to look at the evidence and make sure that they wanted to proceed with a grand jury indictment. This inadvertently, the language said 15 instead of 30 days, so we're just fixing that. The dash one amendments basically relate to weapons forfeiture, and as I've indicated in my written testimony, ORS 166.280 was enacted in 1925. It was repealed when the criminal forfeiture statute was enacted, and so we were left without a good provision to forfeit weapons. The dash one amendments are essentially 166.280 with one significant change. Previously, law enforcement was allowed, once the weapon was forfeited, to sell that and use it as they wanted to. Now it's limited to training, demonstration, court purposes, identification, and crimes. And once the weapon is not used for that purpose anymore, it must be destroyed. With that, I have nothing further.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Vidalins. Officer Durbin.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, my name is Craig Durbin. I am a sergeant with the Oregon State Police and currently the manager of the Drug Enforcement Section here in today's support of Senate Bill 59. We work closely with many of the district attorney's offices throughout the state, and we believe that this bill will fix two problems that we currently have. One is referred to already, and that is the 15-day time period. Oftentimes, we as law enforcement find a person that is committing a crime, and we take and seize the properties of that crime, either instrumentality or proceeds, and then start the investigation at that time period. 15 days is a very short window to conduct an investigation against instrumentality or proceeds of the items that we have seized, and trying to get that investigation completed and then convene a grand jury. And we believe 30 days is even a short window, but it would be much better than the 15. The other problem is the deposition or of the weapons, and that is that these weapons now, under the criminal forfeiture law, each one of those weapons have to be indicted separately. They have to go through the trial process, and because of that, many of the departments are having great difficulty in disposing of these weapons. The other problem is that the State Police Crime Lab uses these weapons for a variety of things. Some of the things that they use them for is that they use it for trajectory reconstruction. They use it to take working weapons and make inoperable weapons from the parts working so that they can take and do analysis on those weapons. They also use it for serial identification on weapons that have been seized where the serial number has been scratched off. They might take other weapons and match up those serial numbers and then find the weapons or be able to take and use those in court purposes. They also use it for IBIS identification, where they'll test fire these weapons, they'll use the bullet or the casing, and then submit those into IBIS for later identification and other crimes. Well, because of right now with the criminal forfeiture law and the way the weapon statute is that it makes it very difficult to get these weapons and to submit them to the State Police Crime Lab. This law will fix that because those weapons then would be treated as contraband. At the time of the trial, they'd be disposed of, and they'd be either disposed of or sent to the police crime lab. So we believe that both of these items would fix this current problem that we have, and this concludes my testimony at this time.
Thank you, Officer Durbin. Are there questions for Officer Durbin or Representative Brzozowski?
Thank you. I just want to put some stuff on the record. It's my understanding that what the Dash ones are going to attempt to do is fix a void that's currently in the statute. When the criminal forfeiture laws came into effect, we did have at that time the ability to claim in front of a court that a weapon was a nuisance and it could then be disposed of as a nuisance. And I had a similar bill that was in that went to rules. Unfortunately, it didn't get to be moved. That I think covers this. But I want to make certain that this is really to an intent to try to fill the void from the nuisance statute being taken off. And it would apply to all weapons that are in any type of criminal offense?
Chair Williams, Representative Przanski, the requirement is that the weapon must be used in the commission of the crime, the individual must be convicted, and then the weapon is declared contraband and then forfeited. And the reason for the difference between nuisance and contraband is because the Constitution was amended by the Oregon Property Protection Act and refers to contraband, not nuisance. And so that's the change. That's the reason for the change.
Okay. But if someone has, let's say, if they're in possession of a firearm inside of a vehicle, there's no drugs involved in that, this statute would be able to be used as a means for forfeiting that weapon if they're convicted.
Chair Williams, Representative Przanski, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And kind of in following one a record, too, in a case where the district attorney on the offense itself, that where there was a conviction, if they had pled that indictment as a deadly weapon for that firearm, is he understanding that that would be within the definition of dangerous weapon for this statute?
Chair Williams, Mr. Prinz, yes. The definition of dangerous weapons includes guns and deadly weapons.
Okay, are there further questions?
One question just based on what counsel has asked.
Yes, Representative.
Does it need to be pleaded as to if you're moving to forfeit against the gun in the proceeding, or is it going to be just a matter of fact if they're convicted of, let's say, carrying concealed weapon?
Chair Williams, Representative Przanski, the way that it's been done before is that it's not pleaded.
Right.
It's simply finding the court makes after the individual's convicted.
Good. I just want to make sure that we got that on the record.
Yes, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure it's just a lawyer thing, but can you help me understand why Section 3 and Section 4 appear to be redundant? But I don't see anything in Section 4 that says it's changing a different part of the statute. I'm talking about the Dash 1 amendments, by the way.
Right. Chair Williams, Representative Crummell, I'm not sure I'm following you.
Section 3 and Section 4 contain the same language. If you go to Section 3, Sub 2, and then Section 3, Sub 3, and Sub 4, it's the same as Section 4, Sub 1, Sub 2, and Sub 3. And I'm just trying to understand why the language is, like I said, I'm sure it's just a lawyer thing, but I'm trying to understand why the statute would be redundant in that if this is going to be all part of the sections 1 to 18 of Chapter 666 of Oregon Laws 2001.
Chair Williams, Representative Crummell, I think the statute will be located in two places, one in the criminal forfeiture statute and then as a standalone statute.
And Mr. Chairman and Representative Crummell, that is because those, if you look at this is as amended by 2001, Chapter 666 is going to amend Section, I think what it does is it makes it clear that it applies to those that were in 2001, Chapter 666. That's why Section 3 and 4 read about the same.
Okay.
That didn't make sense either, did it? Let me take another run at that.
And, you know, that's okay.
A lawyer.
It's a lawyer thing.
I think it's more of a legislative council thing. Maybe that's a better way to word it. All right. Are there any further questions for either of these witnesses? Okay. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
We're going to recess Senate Bill 59 for right now, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 764. And I'll ask Senator Starr to come forward, if you would, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the Judiciary Committee. For the record, Bruce Starr, State Senator from Senate District 15, which incorporates the communities of Hillsborough, Forest Grove, Cornelius, and North Plains in western Washington County. Appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 764 this afternoon. This is a very simple little bill that is really a simple tweak to an existing program that the legislature authorized in previous sessions. This is the photo red light bill. What this bill clearly does, simply does, is it expands a modest expansion of the existing program. The legislature in previous sessions has authorized communities to operate photo red light in four intersections, and the city of Portland could operate photo red light in eight intersections. This bill doubles the number of those intersections. As it was amended in the Senate, the original bill that I had introduced eliminated the restrictions completely, but as is oft necessary in this process, compromise is part of the game, and as we counted votes, it became evident that that was something that needed to happen, at least on the Senate floor. The other part of this bill, I think, that is from my perspective, more important is how we regulate the length of the yellow light, where these photo stoplight, photo red light cameras are used. And on page 2 of the bill, section 3, sub 1, sub C, it directs that the length of the yellow light shall not be less than the standard set by the Institute of Transportation Engineers. And as we had originally drafted the bill, we had selected 4 seconds as the length of the yellow light. But as we talked about and talked to the jurisdictions about that particular issue, it made sense for us to look at the experts and say, okay, how do they determine the length of yellow light? And it has a lot to do with physics and speed and slope and those kinds of things. And there are some pretty clear standards that are set by the experts. And the Institute of Transportation Engineers, from all of the research that I've done and my staff has done, is identified as that group of experts. So they have a list. I mean, they really do as far as what makes sense. Again, it has to do with speed of an intersection and the grade at which that intersection, you know, you have, whether it's 5% or 10% or whatnot. That seems to make sense. From my perspective, it's important that we eliminate, in the public's mind especially, an opportunity for local government to manipulate the length of the yellow light as a means to, quote-unquote, trap folks that would be driving through these intersections and catch them off guards and use a very important tool local governments have for traffic safety as a revenue generator instead. Not to say that any jurisdictions that are using it in Oregon do that, and I wouldn't say that, but I think that for the members of the public that I've talked to, this is an issue that's been raised. There's been significant conversation, I think, at the federal level about this particular issue as it relates to photo stoplight, and that's why I think it's important that we put this in the statute. And I think, from my perspective, it's one of the reasons why I'd encourage you to support Senate Bill 764 and hopefully continue to move it through the process. Simple bill, modest change to existing program, and I'd urge you to support it. If I'd answer any questions, if you might have one.
Further questions for Senator Starr? None at all. Oh, I'm sorry. Down here, Representative Jensen.
Oh, we're in public hearing.
We are in public hearing.
Oh, wait.
Oh, okay. All right.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Senator. If you could hang by the door for a second, I do need to talk to you about something else.
Mr.
Were you going to talk to
me? Yeah. Do you want to?
Why don't you talk to him, and I'll keep running the meeting.
Mr. Chair.
Bruce, what Lane's going to tell you is what I was going to tell you. So, all right. Yes.
Really a question for counsel. I know that we've had a couple other bills dealing with photo red lights and the other photo bill. How does this play in, or is there conflicts as to what we've already passed, understanding that this will at least change or have a requirement as to the length of the yellow light? I'm wondering if we have conflicts of stuff that we've already passed as to opening it up or not.
No, I don't believe we do. I don't believe we do. I think that the photo radar bills run separately and non-conflicting with the photo red light.
Well, I thought we already had a photo red light bill, too. I thought we had two that came through here that were House bills.
I remember we... Mr. Chairman,
never passed out.
Yeah, we did not move the photo red light bill. We moved the...
Okay. Well, we had the hearing on it.
We moved the photo radar
bill, but not the red light bill.
Right.
Okay. That photo red light. That's
right. They sent us red light. We sent them radar.
What a deal.
All right. Okay. So we're not switching gears again, and there are only two witnesses signed up. Why don't I have Linda Adler come up and Dean Meisner from the City of Beaverton.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Linda Adler. I'm Chief of Staff at the City of Beaverton. We're one of a couple cities who have red light enforcement through photo red light. We were the first city in the state to put this into place. Certainly, our citizens have found this to be a very valuable tool. When we look at our polling of citizens, we know that 75% of them favor this kind of enforcement over police officers. We also know that because we're required to do an educational campaign to ensure that people understand what this tool is and so that there's nothing about fooling them about where this is or where the signs are, 93% of our citizens over 3 years as an average understand our program and are aware of it. It also is the second highest rating concern of our residents, the first being aggressive driving, which we see quite a bit of. We've issued about 3,000 citations over the last 2 years. That's staying pretty constant. We also have experienced a 12% decrease in the total number of citations at those intersections. So that's not just red light, but any other kind also. And we've experienced almost a 12% decrease in accidents. So for Beaverton, this has been a great tool. We have it at four intersections. Just to let you know, over the last, I've been there 11 years, we use the standard that is talked about for the yellow light. And at the intersections that we have our photo red light, we have not changed that standard, nor the yellow light for the past 10 years. So with that, I'm happy to ask for your vote on this. And I have my officer here who's out there in the troops to answer any of those kinds of questions from a police perspective for you.
Officer Meisner, do you want to make any comments, or are you just here for
I just would like to reiterate my support for this legislation as well. It it's kind of hard to relate, but you don't know how good it feels to be able to write a red light ticket in front of a computer rather than sitting in the saddle of a motorcycle having to cut through traffic on Canyon Road at 5 in the afternoon to catch the violator. It's a piece of legislation that makes the streets safer for the citizens as well as the guys who are tasked with doing this job. And I got four guys that do that quite a bit, and they're all in favor of it as well.
Yeah, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, the one that I drive through the most is on the, because of it just in my traffic pattern, is the one at Shoals Ferry and Progress, you know, mm-hmm. that one right there. And that's a horrible intersection and, you know, had horrible problems. And I think people behave better because they know it's there. I'm not sure you're getting as many tickets because I think people are modifying their behavior because they know they're coming up at an intersection where there's a photo red light and they're going to come to a complete stop and not play games with trying to run the yellow because they know they're going to get tagged. So I'm very positive about it.
Mr. Chair, our city council believes the best thing that could happen is to put us out of business on this so yeah. that we have a perfectly safe environment for our citizens.
Right. Great. And council said, when I mean drive through, I mean that's the intersection I drive through.
You heard the red light.
Yeah, not the red light. I have not gotten one of those tickets. I've gotten plenty of others, but not that kind. All right. Are there any questions on this issue for either of these? Yes, Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm always quizzical as to why this is limited to 30,000, and why is this not just an option for any city that really feels it's committed?
It's not Newburgh's in there.
Well, you know what? We're going to.
30,000.
You know, it's an excellent question. I think it gets back to the same conversation. It gets back to the same conversation that we had earlier on the photo radar bill. There are people who don't mind this happening in some jurisdictions, but they're not interested in having it in their own, and so there'd be a no if it was expanded statewide. And I think that's generally been how this thing has developed over time. I do think that the time will come when people are comfortable with this technology to the point that we'll do away with the silly list and just give communities statewide the opportunity to do this if they want to do it. But I venture to guess that if we ran the bill out that way right now, we're not there on the floor, nor would we probably get the concurrence votes we need in the Senate to let this happen. Representative Jensen, does that... That gets into the subject matter you wanted to get into, I suspect.
That is the subject matter I wanted to get into, and when we get to work session, I will continue to be a no vote on any bill that has the arrogance to oppose or to propose a particular technology or particular mode of enforcement for one section of the state that is not available in other sections of the state.
Yeah,
The good chair's comments on this. I understand what he's saying, but the law does state that any city may, doesn't say will, at their own expense,
sure,
operate. And of course, the qualifier is 30,000 or 300,000 or some other ridiculous number.
Yeah. And Representative Jensen, you know that I agree with you in yeah. spirit on this point. And it's just a matter of taking the bites of the elephant one at a time, I think.
I understand that, sir.
All right. Are there any other questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 764, and I am going to open a work session on Senate Bill 764.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzozinski.
Move Senate Bill 764A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Brzozinski moves Senate Bill 764A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering if you would like to give the officer from Beaverton your license number, and in that way, if perchance you ever did slip on the intersection, he could write
me a note.
He could just send you a note.
Yeah, a little note. I'm sure they'd send me a note, Representative.
With a date to appear.
Yeah, right. Representative Anderson.
Yeah, but the question is, Mr. Chair, is whether you have diplomatic immunity. I mean, I think that's been claimed before.
All right, we're not going there. Representative Anderson. You need to adjust your mic.
Well, I do agree with the good representative from Pendleton. I think I will vote for this bill, but I can assure you that in 2 years we'll have an amendment to it.
Oh, yeah. I'm confident. Anybody else? Okay. So the motion is to move the bill with a due pass recommendation. If you want to call the roll, Ann.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
No.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative Pearson?
Aye.
Representative Fugonski?
Aye.
Representative Cheverly?
Excused.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Senate Bill 764 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. That can either be Representative Barker.
My district.
Yeah, it's part of your district, so that's fine if you're happy carrying it.
I'd be glad.
All right.
I'd be happy to carry it.
I know you would. I'm looking forward to your illustrative floor speech, Representative Jensen, as always. All right, now I'm going to return us and reopen from our recess the hearing on Senate Bill 59 at the top of the agenda, and apologize that we had to break that one off midstream to accommodate Senator Starr, but would invite Kelly Skye to come forward.
Good afternoon, Chair Williams, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And while we are neutral as to the original bill, interested in reviewing the amendments today, I do have some concerns about the broad definition of dangerous weapon. And I apologize, I do not have my criminal code with me. Perhaps Council Prince has it. The definition of dangerous weapon is at ORS 161015, and my experience in the criminal justice system is that anything can be a dangerous weapon. So if I were to use this book in a manner that here's the definition. It means any weapon, device, instrument, material, or substance which under the circumstances in which it is used, attempted to be used, or threatened to be used, is readily capable of causing death or serious physical injury. We frequently see shoes pled as a dangerous weapon. Furniture, for instance, in many domestic violence cases, if a person is pushed against a stove in a manner in which the stove causes injury, the stove is pled as a dangerous weapon. The sidewalk frequently is pled as a dangerous weapon. So you can see this is it's a very broad definition. And so my concern here is that with such a broad definition and a very broad use of that definition, the subsection 2 does not provide the court any discretion as to whether to declare that weapon contraband and order that it be forfeited. So you can see where there would be circumstances in which a court would feel that they might be required to declare the stove a weapon contraband and order that it be forfeited. And in speaking with the proponents of the bill, I understand that that's not their intent, that their intent is to actually capture guns and knives. But I can also see how courts may look at this and feel that they don't have any discretion.
Why don't Ms. Vittelins, do you want to come back up?
Yeah.
Did you have more testimony, Kelly?
No.
Okay. So you're okay with the original bill. You've got reservations on the amendments based on the broad definition of dangerous weapon and its expansion of potential forfeiture to things that you guys weren't anticipating. I assume when we were talking, we were basically talking about guns and knives. Is that accurate?
Chair Williams, that's correct. Although the idea of not allowing, say, somebody who's been convicted of assaulting somebody with a brick, you know, for them to have the brick back, I think is important as well. The thing that's interesting is that ORS 166.28280 talks about dangerous, not deadly, although I've never heard of a case in Oregon where there was an attempt to forfeit shoes or anything else other than a gun or a knife under the prior 166.280, and that's our intent. Our problem is we don't want to cut anything off. At the same time, I don't think prosecutors are going to be forfeiting stoves under this section.
Representative Kosansky.
I'm wondering, it sounds to me that the criminal defense lawyers would be comfortable if it was firearms. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then I would ask Diana, if you look and remember how that nuisance statute was written for 166.250, it was limited to firearms. And it does seem like we're now expanding it to be broader than what maybe this, that what was before us prior under the nuisance, and also maybe broader than what the people of the state voted on when they enacted criminal forfeiture.
Chair Williams, Representative Przanski, I believe it covered dangerous weapons, because certainly 280 talks about carrying concealed weapons, knives, those kinds of things.
Well, my quick review of 250, which is not in effect now, but goes back in effect, if I remember correctly, in like 05, I thought it just said carrying a firearm concealed or unlawful possession of a firearm and possession of handguns. I don't remember it applying to other weapons.
Chair Williams, Representative Przanski, we're talking about 166.280, not 250. And if you go to the statutes, it's now 166.281 because 166.281 comes back in when the criminal forfeiture statute sunsets in 05. And so 280, 281 are exactly the same. And that language is, it talks about machine gun, pistol, revolver, other firearm capable of being concealed, or any firearm or any dangerous weapon described in ORS 161.015.
So, Kelly, let me ask a question. Because I assume that a dangerous weapon could also be an automobile, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so in a situation where somebody's used their automobile in a manner that constitutes this kind of crime, and and they get the conviction, and the automobile can be forfeited as a result of that, I think that's a policy that's fairly consistent with what we've done legislatively along these lines, and even after we got through the process of going through the revisions that we adopted last session after the initiative had passed. How do we define it? Because I don't think we want to just say guns and knives when I think there's a valid public purpose for wanting to forfeit, for example, an automobile if somebody's used it, or a baseball bat, or I mean, how do you propose that we define it in a way that because, or again, do we come back to the situation where it's best left to sort of prosecutorial discretion, that they're not going to try to forfeit somebody's stove if the stove was used as a dangerous weapon necessarily, but they would if it was a baseball bat or an automobile or, maybe a ski pole that was used to try to stab somebody. I mean, what's your thought?
Chair Williams, I have two thoughts along those lines. The first is that we could allow judicial discretion so that a judge could say, well, I don't think that this is appropriate under the circumstances, because the way that Section 3 here is written, the court shall declare the weapon to be contraband and order that the weapon be forfeited, doesn't give the court discretion to make exceptions in certain circumstances. The other difference that I wanted to point out from the amendments language and the prior language is 166.281 requires that the weapon actually be used during the commission of any felony or misdemeanor, and this language is much broader than that. It says possessed, used, or available to use. So that's a second difference, and perhaps I can give one illustration along the automobile lines just to add to your thoughts. Our office represented a victim of domestic violence. She had repeatedly been the victim of domestic violence and eventually used her car to drive at and strike her abuser. And this was a case that was hotly contested and negotiated in Multnomah County. And ultimately, her choice to use her vehicle as a dangerous or deadly weapon in this circumstance was beyond the reasonable use of force, because she was not in immediate danger of being killed, and therefore self-defense was not a complete defense. But this is a circumstance in which perhaps a judge may not want to forfeit this person's vehicle. She did ultimately I believe, negotiate a settlement with the state. But under this statute, the court would have no discretion not to forfeit that vehicle.
Ms. Vittelins, what about giving the judge, taking that shall and making it a may, and allowing on judicial discretion to determine when it would be appropriate for that, whatever that weapon was, since it can be everything potentially from a shoe to an automobile, giving that judge the discretion to determine when it would be appropriate for that to forfeit?
Chair Williams, the ORS 166.28 doesn't provide that for that, but I am inclined to think that we'd rather have the broad definition of dangerous weapon and leave it to the court's discretion rather than narrow the definition of weapon, I think.
Is this something that if we gave you guys 48 hours to talk through and work on, that you think you could come back to the committee with a solution that strikes the balance between, you know, sort of swinging the pendulum either too far one direction or the other?
Yes, sir.
I think so.
You think so? Representative Ackman?
Yes. Let me see if this is correct. As I read existing law, the Forfeiture Council files information or indictment alleging facts sufficient to establish that the property is subject to criminal forfeiture. And I have seen some of these indictments and seen some of these complaints. It seems to me that the issue as to whether it's a dangerous weapon depends upon what's pled and what's proven. Isn't this a jury question? And shouldn't we leave it for the jury to make this decision?
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, I think that you're correct, and I think that in reading this, this talks about the court will make this determination or shall declare the weapon to be contraband at sentencing. So I think that this statute contemplates that the person has already been convicted by a judge or jury and it has been found to be a dangerous weapon. Although, on second thought, because this it includes that extra language, used or available for use, I doubt very much that a jury is ever going to be declaring whether, I can't think of a crime in which they would be making a finding as to whether a particular weapon was available for use, and that may be a factual finding that's just open for the court. But again, my problem with this is not so much my concern that prosecutors are going to be going after the stove, it's that this directs the court to declare it contraband and order it to be forfeited.
But isn't a proper interpretation is that that's the court's mandate after a jury verdict declaring the item to be a dangerous weapon, and the court has no discretion but to make the declaration and make the disposition. In other words, the court's discretion is not standing alone. It must have a jury verdict that this is a dangerous weapon.
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, I think that's an interesting issue and one that I didn't see initially. I don't think that from reading this amendment that it's clear that this has to be upon a jury verdict. I think here it says, at the time of sentencing for any criminal defense in which the dangerous weapon was possessed, used, or available for use, and I don't see this as requiring a special jury question, which is what it sounds like you are suggesting, and maybe I think if I'm correct, and I am not a forfeiture expert, but I think that what this bill seeks to do is take the forfeiture of weapons and make it an easier process by having the court declare the weapon as contraband and forfeiting it rather than having to indict the weapon to seize it. So it sort of puts us in a different situation.
And as you were commenting about the, so for example, this would also include any time that you were being sentenced under a plea, for example. And so again, even in a plea situation, there wouldn't necessarily be the discretion as the statute writes it. If the plea includes, you know, the crime where this weapon would have been the dangerous weapon, then the judge is going to be obligated to forfeit, to exercise the forfeiture ability. I think my preference would be, since it seems like we're all talking generally the same direction, but just how to define it, I'd like to give you guys an opportunity, because I know this forfeiture discussion is one that a lot of people have spent a lot of time on, to have at least a chance to figure out if there's some place you can get to on this together. Representative Przanski?
Mr. Chair, and if they're going to do that, it seems like the Asset Oversight Committee may need to. I know they've met on this. I don't know if they had a consensus on this bill coming forward, but I believe maybe Michelle Burrows or Sean McCray, someone that does forfeiture work, may need to be at least requested to have their input on to what should be the appropriate language to capture this.
And Chair Williams, Representative Przanski, I did attempt to get a hold of Michelle Burrows. As I understand, Andrea Meyer said she's in trial, but Sean McCray is a good idea. I'll try to get someone who's more of an expert than myself.
And I apologize. I've got a meeting to go to, so we're going to adjourn, or no, not adjourn, I'm sorry. We're going to conclude the public hearing on Senate Bill 59, and I'm going to turn the gavel over to Representative Ackerman for the remainder of the meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 104A.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Symbol 104A, Mike Livingston is here. He's already making his way to the dais. Symbol 104 deals with, was amended. There were two bills in the Senate. This one has been amended down to deal with the issue that was troubling for the courts had to do with adding and making clear that the sections that we amended in 2001 to deal with the appealability of judgments included delinquency judgments. And I will let Mr. Livingston explain that in more detail.
Thank you. Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Livingston. I'm an attorney in the Appellate Division of the Department of Justice. In 2001, the Oregon Judicial Department proposed, and this legislature enacted, House Bill 2336, the intent of which was to conform appellate practice in juvenile cases with appellate practice in civil cases by making appeals from juvenile court judgments rather than juvenile court orders appealable. In other words, it was just to harmonize the terminology used to refer to the appealable document or instrument. Inadvertently, as a result of a drafting error, the Judicial Department's bill omitted authority to appeal from delinquency cases. The way the statute, which is the bill, which is codified as 419A205, is written, it only allows appeals from dependency cases and not delinquency cases. Senate Bill 104A amends the statute by basically filling in that omission, making appeals from juvenile court delinquency judgments appealable, just like juvenile court dependency judgments are appealable. Section 2 of the bill makes this an emergency clause. I should add that to my knowledge, no delinquency appeal has been refused because of this omission in the statute, but it is a necessary change to the statute.
Questions of the witness from the committee? Hearing none. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
This is the only person we have signed up for testimony on Senate Bill 104A. Is there anyone else that has an interest in, that would like to speak? Otherwise, I will close the public hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 104A.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I will move Senate Bill 104A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
It's been moved by Representative McPherson to move Senate Bill 104A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion from the committee? Hearing none, I'll ask that the roll be called on the vote.
Representative Barker?
Excuse.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Przanski?
Aye.
Representative Federley?
Aye.
Vice
Chair
Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Excuse. Senate Bill 104A is submitted to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 105.
Oh, carrier on that one.
Mr. Chair, you need a carrier for that bill?
Oh, yes. Volunteers? Representative Crumlin. I guess that's what I get for saying you need a carrier for that bill.
May I suggest a consent count? No, that's fine. Talk your head.
Okay. We've got to resolve.
Thank you.
A bit of trouble. We'll take it. I've opened the public hearing on Senate Bill 105.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 105. Ms. Gallagher's here from Department of Justice. She runs the Criminal Victims Assistance Fund there. This bill, as I recall from the testimony, has to do with a, first of all, it allows for losses in compensation for counseling for victims of international terrorism. And I believe there was a specific fact case involving some men that worked for Ericsson Air Crane that were kidnapped, as I recall. So I'm sure Ms. Gallagher can explain that.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I have two proponents, Connie Gallagher and Georgia Griffin. I only see one of you. Well, let's both come up at the same time. Would be helpful.
Mr. Vice Chair and members of the committee, I'm Connie Gallagher. I'm Director of the Crime Victims Assistance Section with the Oregon Department of Justice. Today's bill, along with two others that you'll be hearing, has to do with the Crime Victims Compensation Program. This is a program that was established in 1977 through ORS 147.225. Its purpose is a simple one, and that is to ease the financial burden that's inflicted upon innocent victims of person crimes. It reimburses eligible victims of certain crimes for certain expenses, such as medical costs, counseling, loss of support, funeral expenses. The Crime Victims Compensation Program is always the payer of last resort. What we are proposing in Senate Bill 105 are relatively small changes that are not going to have a significant impact either in the fiscal sense or in terms of a large number of individuals that will benefit from these changes. However, it is a very important change to those victims who are currently excluded from this type of benefit, and it is at their request that we are bringing this bill forward to you today. One of the significant changes is to amend the current law so as to allow crime victims compensation counseling benefits only up to $1,000 to be available for Oregon residents who are family members of an individual who's being held in a foreign country. Currently, what the program provides is if there's an Oregon resident who is a hostage in a foreign country, then they would be eligible for benefits. But as you will hear from Ms. Griffin, who is with the FBI, there are situations, and unfortunately it's increasingly frequent, where there are family members left here in Oregon wondering what is happening to their loved one who is a hostage in another country, and they would like to be able to ask the state for assistance in terms of counseling benefits. Another change is that we would amend the maximum allowable for a funeral expense from $3,500 up to $5,000. And again, this is simply to reflect the current market costs in terms of funeral expenses. The last important change in this bill provides additional authority for the Attorney General to issue state grants if funding is available for nonviolent crimes such as fraud and property crimes. Currently, the statute limits the authority of the Attorney General to issue this specific type of discretionary grant to services to victims of violent crime. And again, we're proposing this because it's in response to an unfortunately growing incident of financial fraud and elder abuse crimes. And unfortunately, the statute does not provide for us to be able to issue these discretionary grants in order for the types of services that these victims need. In addition to that, there are several other changes to the statute, but they are housekeeping in nature. So at this point, I will turn it over to Ms. Griffin.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Georgia Griffin, and I'm the victim specialist with the FBI in Oregon. I've been employed by the FBI for 22 years, and I'm here today to give testimony in support of Senate Bill 105. My role is victim coordinator. I work with those who are affected by FBI investigations, including both victims and their families. I would like to give testimony concerning a particular case in which I was involved, that of three Oregon men who were kidnapped and held for ransom while working in Ecuador. Arnold Offert, Stephen Derry, and Jason Weber, all of Gold Hill, Oregon, were employees at Eric's Jackson Air Crane. They were among 10 oil workers who were kidnapped in Ecuador by guerrillas in October of 2000, and they were held for 141 days before being released. While the FBI Miami Division was responsible for the investigation of this kidnapping, it was my responsibility to contact and provide referrals to the three men's families here in Oregon. While it's my function to provide support and referrals to outside agencies for victims of federal crimes, or in this case to the families of the victims, the money to pay for such things as psychological counseling for Oregon crime victims comes from the Oregon Crime Victims Compensation Program. As the days turned into weeks and then the weeks into months, not knowing if they would ever see their loved ones again alive, the Crime Victims Compensation Program was contacted regarding this case in hopes of providing counseling benefits for the wives, the children, and the other immediate family members here in Oregon. However, because this case involved an international kidnapping, there was no provision in Oregon's current state law that would allow these three families access to compensation awards for counseling expenses. Currently, the only way the families would qualify for those funds would be if those three victims had actually died. Fortunately, this was not the case in this case. International terrorism will continue to plague our nation into the 21st century, but the effectiveness with which we respond to these events will certainly define the character and quality of our state and our federal victim assistance network. This bill, if passed, would be a small step in the right direction, and I thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Would this bill have any effect on members of the armed services that go overseas if they were held as POWs or if they were missing in action?
Mr. Vice Chair and Representative Crumholt, no, this bill would not have any effect on that.
Okay. Further questions to the witnesses?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Connie, we talked about the role of state mental health in this. Could you, and I think it weaves its way through several of these bills, could you explain what you found, or do you have somebody here from mental health to talk to?
Mr. Vice Chair and Representative Jensen, one of the questions that arose was the issue of what is the role of county mental health programs and state mental health programs. And just to explain a little bit about how our program works with the state and county mental health programs, generally what they can provide are services to individuals who have health insurance or health mental health benefits, such as the Oregon Health Plan or their private insurance carrier. What I found in talking to these programs is that they're more than happy to provide counseling services to those individuals, but if they do not have insurance, then they request anywhere between $92 an hour to $150 an hour for any type of counseling services. Obviously, that's a prohibitive amount for many of the victims that come to us seeking financial assistance so that they may receive counseling services. I did find one program that still has a sliding fee scale, but they have a limited number of slots. And even to access those slots, you have to wait 4 to 6 weeks in order to get an initial appointment. So what we see is that our program is necessary in order to cover deductibles that a victim might need to cover, even if they do have insurance. It's also necessary to cover counseling costs for individuals who don't have any insurance. We estimate that that's probably about 20% of the individuals that apply for crime victims compensation. Also, of course, for individuals whose counseling exceeds the maximum that their insurance might allow, again, they turn to the state so that they can complete their treatment plan for counseling services.
Thank you, Connie. Can I follow?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, I'm not real sure that I would want to stand in the way of this legislation. I think there's a real question that's raised, though, with this issue. We spend a lot of money in the state of Oregon. Admittedly, we have some match money that comes in on that, but in the area of mental health. It seems to me that we're running something of a duplication as far as money is concerned here. And I'd like to see this issue addressed within the framework of the mental health system in the state to see if there isn't some way to incorporate this into the delivery system that is already in place, realizing that not every mental health clinic is going to ever have, or some may never have, occasion to, you know, be tapped in here or to demand or require these services. But it seems that maybe we've gotten into too much of a fee-based program there without consideration perhaps of the need, and I would be interested in a subsequent legislature looking at this particular issue to see if there isn't some way for some incorporation of this program or these services into a delivery system that's already fairly widespread across the state.
Further discussion? Mr. Chair?
Representative Cromwell?
Thank you. Do we have a definition for international terrorism?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Cromwell, I'm not sure whether we do or not. I would have to research that.
Well, it's not defined in the bill. Is that correct?
Mr. Vice Chair, that's correct.
All right. And then, if I may,
sure.
And I hope I'm not repeating what Representative Jensen said, but I'm. And did you say where the money comes from that fills this? That fulfills these expenses when they're applied for?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Crummell, the sources for the Crime Victims Compensation Program come from three different sources, one federal source. Then it comes from the criminal fines and assessment account. There's a biennial allocation that supports this. In addition to that, there's multiple sources, the primary source of which are punitive damage awards. 60% of those come to the crime victims criminal injuries compensation account, of which some of that money goes to support the crime victims compensation program. Complicated.
So I think generally what you're saying is separate funding sources for this program is in contrast to the funding for mental health services in the state generally. There's no merger of these two systems.
Right.
Mr. Vice Chair, that's correct, and there's also no general fund.
Right. And until we can have that kind of merger, I don't see how we can have a comprehensive policy. So, again, that goes beyond the scope of this particular bill, however. Okay, further discussion. Council.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to... international terrorism is defined in ORS 147.005. Means activities that involve violent acts or acts dangerous to human life that are a violation of the criminal laws of the United States or any state, or that would be a criminal violation if committed within the jurisdiction of the United States or of any state.
Thank you. Thank you, Counsel. Good find. Further discussion from the committee. Witnesses are excused. Thank you. I have no one else to testify, so I will close the public hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 105.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
I move Senate Bill 105 to the floor with a DuPass recommendation.
Further discussion from the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I just have one question, and maybe counsel can answer this, and that is on the testimony was with regards to the punitive damages assessments going into part of it goes into this fund. What exactly does that mean? Does that mean that if I sued somebody and got a punitive damage award, that I would actually only receive 40% of that punitive damage award, and the other 60% would go to
Correct.
This fund. Is that what this?
That's exactly what it means.
So you have to actually sue for about four times what you really want, right?
Mr. Chairman, I mean, punitive damages are not, they go beyond your injuries. They're not compensating the victim for the injuries that they've sustained because of a cause. They're to punish. And so I think most commonly we see them in situations where there's a corporation that is being punished, and it goes beyond the compensation for the victim. And those are the ones that, because it's an action that is for the good, basically, of the state, it goes to the state through DOJ.
Okay. Representative, it's viewed as a, you might view it as a civil fine or a civil penalty. It also has to be established in court by clear and convincing evidence, which is a higher standard. And the courts have upheld the statutory framework against a variety of constitutional challenges. So it's here.
Yep.
Okay, further questions from the committee? We have a motion to recommend Senate Bill 105 to the House floor with due pass recommendation. Hearing no further discussion, please call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jim?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative
Jensen?
Aye.
Representative
Tedderly?
Aye.
Vice Chairman?
Aye.
Vice Chairman?
Aye.
Call in.
Excuse.
Okay. Representative Jensen, you'd like to carry this? Okay. Representative Jensen will carry a Senate Bill 105. I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 106.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I assume Ms. Gallagher is going to come back on this. Senate Bill 106 deals with, again, criminal victims compensation program. It expands the definition of survivor, so it would mean a household member of a deceased victim, so that they could, compensation amounts could be given to that person if they are, if they're needed because of their relationship to the victim. And then in Section 2, this deals with making it clear that when a crime victim applies basically for funds from the Department of Justice, they surrender or waive certain records, and this makes it clear that those records are to be given to Department of Justice, including medical service records from the treating hospital.
Good afternoon.
Hello, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. I'm Connie Gallagher, Director of Crime Victims Assistance Section with the Oregon Department of Justice. This bill, like the bill that you just heard, Senate Bill 105, does not impact a large number of individuals, but again, we are being responsive to those requests we do get that do not have a large fiscal impact to the program, but have a significant fiscal impact to the individual. In this case, as committee counsel has just described, the change that we are requesting is to add to the current definition of survivor in order to allow household members to be eligible just for a certain type of benefit through the compensation program. The type of benefit they would now be eligible for is grief counseling, and only in the event that there is a homicide of a fellow household member. And again, as we all know, relationships are not necessarily defined legally to the extent that if we're concerned about helping individuals who are impacted by crime, we need to look beyond the legal definition. And in this case, what we are proposing is that we identify household members as individuals who would be able to request additional financial assistance through the compensation program in the event of the death of and in particular, homicide of a fellow household member. The second change in this bill is one that's geared at making our program more efficient. I know that you've heard bills related to HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. This act, while we are not a covered entity, has an effect on the Crime Victims Compensation Program because we require medical information pertaining to the individuals that we are trying to assist. We have already encountered barriers and things that delay us in processing the applications for crime victims. What we are proposing in this bill is not a change in any sense. It's merely a clarification that will help us expedite the applications for crime victims.
Again, there's no significant fiscal impact on this bill. It would just be of assistance to victims and be of assistance in terms of the efficiency of our program. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of Ms. Gallagher from the committee? Mr. Chair. Representative Crummell.
When you said definition of a household member, so are we getting into the issue of a victim's significant other?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Crummell, there's certainly a possibility of that, along with college roommates, fiancés, family friends who might be living in the household. What we do intend to do is to further define it through administrative rule that those individuals need to have been living within the household for a certain length of time.
Further questions of the witness? Hearing none. Representative Jensen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I assume that somewhere or another in here, things like stepchild would or stepchildren would qualify. Is that correct?
Mr. Vice Chair and Representative Jensen, yes, they actually are already qualified.
Further questions of the committee? Hearing none, I'll excuse the witness and conclude the public hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 106. Motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I move Senate Bill 106 to the floor with a recess recommendation.
And discussion. Hearing none, I'll call for the roll call vote.
Mr. Chair. Did we adopt the amendments to this? I see there's House amendments proposed for A and Gross, Senate Bill 106.
106?
I do not have one.
House amendment?
I have them. And it was to add a emergency clause.
I don't have
any.
I believe
it's already been added. That's fine.
We're okay.
We're okay. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative
Crummell? Aye.
Representative
McPherson? Aye. Representative Krasinski? Aye. Representative Shetterly?
Excused.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Mr. Williams?
Excused. Senate Bill 105 is referred to the House with a due pass recommendation.
106.
Excuse me?
106.
To the House with a due pass recommendation. Carrier, Representative McPherson. I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 108, and we will only have a public hearing today. We will not proceed to work session.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Fussner from the Department of Justice is coming up. Says almost so brief, I don't want to steal his thunder, so wait and he'll tell you what this bill is about.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jonathan Fussner. I'm the attorney in charge of criminal appeals in the Department of Justice. What Senate Bill 108 does is it fixes an anomaly in the criminal sentencing law. As the law stands now, a person convicted of any offense, from the most minor up to the most serious Class A felonies, can be sentenced to pay a fine. Murderers cannot. Not so much as a $10 fine. They can be sent to prison or executed, but they cannot be fined. And while it may be somewhat rare to find a person convicted of murder or aggravated murder who has resources, occasionally it does happen. And in fact, we have had one sentence overturned in the Court of Appeals where a judge found that a convicted murderer did have assets and could pay a fine, ordered the person to pay it. They appealed, and it's true, there's no provision for a fine for murder. All Senate Bill 108 does is it provides for a $300,000 fine upon a conviction for murder or aggravated murder, which is the same amount of fine as already is provided for any Class A felony. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did the thought ever cross anyone's mind in looking at this proposed amendment to maybe make it $1 million fine for aggravated murder as a separate category, have instead of three categories, four?
Well, I have to say, Chair Ackerman and Representative Jensen, the thought did cross my mind. I think the reality is we're never going to find anybody who can pay anything like that, limiting it to $300,000 seemed like a pretty optimistic level as it was.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I realize those cases would be rare, but I also suspect that if we ever do find somebody that falls into that category, it's going to be an extremely expensive trial. I don't know. It would strike me as not being unreasonable.
In that case, since we're not going to proceed to work session, Representative Jensen, you may have an opportunity to submit a $1 million amendment. Further discussion, Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fessner, just out of curiosity, when a if a person who is committed convicted of murder or aggravated murder, and the Constitution now says that while they're in prison, they have to work. Would the fine basically be then taken out of the money that they earn as a prisoner in a work program?
Chair Ackerman and Representative Cremel, I'm sorry to tell you that my expertise does not extend to what can be done with the money that inmates earn. I could certainly attempt to find out, but I simply don't know whether that money is subject to being levied for payment of a fine like this.
Okay, thank you. Further questions of the witness from the committee? Hearing none, I'll excuse the witness, and it's the chair's intention to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 108, unless there's anyone else ready to testify. Seeing no other witnesses, the public hearing is concluded. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 111.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 111 would expand the people who are eligible for counseling expenses to include those people pay for such expenses and are a friend or acquaintance of the victim or the first person to discover a deceased victim.
Mr. Barber.
Mr. Ackerman, committee members. My name is Jason Barber. I'm the assistant director for the Crime Victims Assistance Section. Here today in support of Senate Bill 111. Basically, every year, Crime Victim Compensation Program gets a small number of claims from individuals that are the first people to discover a deceased body of a family friend or acquaintance as a result of a criminal incident. And just to give you an example, back on January of 2002, Mark Harris of Portland, Oregon filed a claim with our program as a result of discovering the deceased body of his 14-year-old neighbor girl in his backyard. He filed a claim with us. Unfortunately, the way the statutes are currently written, we were unable to provide him with any counseling. This bill would basically allow some short-term crisis benefits available for those individuals. Compensation by state and federal law is the payer of last resort, so if these crime victims did have Oregon Health Plan or private insurance, they'd have to access that first. And if they did not have that, as in Mr. Harris's case, we would be able to provide that crisis counseling up to a maximum of $500 per deceased body. Mr. Harris wasn't able to join us today for testimony, but he did send me his testimony via email, and we've attached that to the back of our handout. And that basically concludes testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Fine. Thank you for your testimony. Questions from the committee? Hearing none, I'll excuse the witness and ask if there's any other persons in the audience that wish to testify for or against Senate Bill 111. Seeing none, hearing none, we'll conclude the public hearing on Senate Bill 111 and open the work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przonski.
Move Senate Bill 111 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Przonski moves Senate Bill 111 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion from the committee. Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Kummel?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Podolsky?
Aye.
Representative Federley?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Excuse. Senate Bill 111 is forwarded to the House with a due pass recommendation. I need a carrier. Representative Prozonsky. I'll close the public hearing or the work session on Senate Bill 111. There's no further business before the committee, and I therefore declare the session adjourned.